Oppenheimer.
I think they're talking about us. No way.
I myself am strange and unusual.
Listen, Nerd Right Radio!
Nerd Alert!
These nerds are a threat to our way of life.
See, this is the stuff that brings nerds together.
So it's sort of social. Demented and sad, but social, right?
If I'm interested in it, then by definition, it is nerdy.
Are you in loser denial or something?
I'm a nerd, and I'm pretty proud of it.
My dad's a nerd.
And welcome to episode 9 of Nerd Pride Radio. 9, the number of rings of power given to men, and thus the number of ring wraiths which were created when those 9 succumbed to Sauron's power. So, ask me how I'm doing today. Go on, ask me. I'm awesome! Oh, my name is Mike Jones. I'm a D&D nerd, sci-fi nerd, comic book nerd, computer nerd, movie nerd, science nerd, gaming nerd, and probably about 7 other kinds of nerd that I only wish I was nerdy enough to be. You're listening to Nerd Pride Radio, the place where I go every week to ramble on about all the nerd stuff that won't fit in my brain anymore. Oh, my co-host this week, a Scotsman on a horse. So, we'll get right to the meticulously plotted portion of the podcast. This is the time for me when I talk about whatever's been on my mind for the last week. Something strikes me as interesting, I add it to my master list, and the best stuff gets spewed out onto you every week when I record. You lucky dogs. Ah, so we'll go straight to the master list.
I thought this was bowling for weirdos.
This just in, we have a nerd culture report. Okay, nerd culture reports are just going to be me talking about just general nerd stuff. Things that I noticed, things in the news related to nerddom, that kind of thing. And actually, this is just a personal observation. Lately, I have noticed this guy who works at a local store here. And his name is, at least that's what his name tag tells me. And I'm guessing he's a black guy and possibly half black. I don't know. I can't judge. But he is just slightly overweight, has this big old fro, a mustache like Cleveland from Family Guy, and he just, every time I see him, he's a really nice guy, really helpful, does well at his job, and every time I see him, I think, God, I wish I had a Nerd Pride Radio business card to just hand this guy. He's probably, a high school senior, just out of high school, something like that, and he just looks like the kind of guy who would love this podcast. I just imagine that he's got his Spider-Man comic book collection at home. I just know he has polyhedral dice hidden somewhere in his room. And so it occurs to me, how do you recruit somebody for your podcast? How do you just walk up to a total stranger and go, dude, you look like a nerd. I bet you would fit in so well with these guys. Why don't you come on over? I'm never going to do that because that's just creepy. And for all I know, Chris Hansen's just waiting around the corner to show up and tell me that I'm on Dateline. So, it's just a weird feeling. And you get that every now and then, you spot somebody somewhere and you're like, if we had a secret handshake or something, a code phrase, a something, cause you just know that, oh God, they're in the club. They're part of us. They should be here. And yet I don't have any good way to approach them. So, maybe I'll open it up to you guys on the forums. What's the best way to approach a potential nerd and let him in on the fact that, hey, I'm a nerd too. We could hang out maybe, right? You could at least come by and listen to my podcast, because that's what I really want. So maybe I'll open it up to you guys. What do you think? I don't even know.
I've got Dungeon Master's Guide. I've got 12-sided die.
That's right. Role-playing, video games, card games, if it fits on my gaming table, then I'm going to share it with you. Today, I had this. I actually think this was a topic on one of the Podomatic entries, but it kind of caught my attention and ties into some other stuff I'm thinking about. The entry just says pre-generated characters and random encounter tables. And this is for role-playing games in specific. If you're not familiar with role-playing games, pre-generated characters means the game master or whoever's designed this adventure has come up with a character ahead of time for you and just hands you a character and tells you to go ahead and play it. Those are pre-generated characters. And then random encounter tables is very classic D&D kind of stuff where you have a table of potential random things that might happen. And so when the dungeon master is bored or when you're on the road traveling and, well, okay, it's time for a random encounter, you roll up some dice and, hey, look, it's Blink Dogs or whatever it is. And then the fight goes. And a lot of people are very against these. And specifically, the reason I bring it up is because I listen to the Fear the Boot podcast. If you're not familiar with Fear the Boot, they are a dry but very funny and informative, in my opinion, podcast out there about role-playing games. And they're very D&D heavy in their perspective, but they cover a lot of different stuff. But one of the things that annoys me when I listen to Fear the Boot is that whenever someone brings up random encounter tables, they completely blow it off and dismiss it as if this was the stupidest thing that ever happened. As far as they're concerned, random encounter table, that has absolutely nothing to do with our plot. There's no point to having it in there. Why would you even do something like that? And very similarly, when it comes to pre-generated characters, oh, again, they are so violently opposed to the idea of someone else making a character for them. It's like, as a player, this is the one area where I have control. Why would you take that away from me when you know, this is my heart and soul going into this character? It has to be someone that I designed. All right. And to me, just, there's nothing wrong with having that attitude. There's nothing wrong with preferring not to have random stuff, preferring not to. I mean, it all comes down to, though, the idea of somebody else putting ideas into your game. All right. And for me, if you've ever played my Instinct game, mine and my brother's Instinct game, in fact, you would know that we're all about the random. And random doesn't have to mean meaningless. And this is the part that is important to me, is that when we play a round of Instinct game, we roll the dice, and the dice tell us what kind of setting we're going to have. The dice tell us what the enemy looks like. The dice tell us the basic elements of a plot. The dice can tell us the personalities of the people we're going to meet. The dice determine all sorts of stuff, and it's completely random. And as a game master, and also as players, it's our job to actually put those together in a meaningful way. And it becomes a real challenge to make a coherent story out of, you know, suddenly I've got 1970s Milwaukee, dragons, and a plot to destroy a valuable heirloom. That's all we know. And so from that, I have to take those elements and the characters that people come up with and put them together into an actual story. And there's something really challenging and really fun about that. And to me also, the exact same way, pre-generated characters, again, most times, you know, a lot of people, creating the character is one of their favorite parts of the game. They love either rolling the dice to generate their character or, more often, assigning the points and deciding where you're going to put these skills or which spells you're going to have or what powers you want your character to be able to use. And that's a huge deal for a lot of people. In fact, there have been times in my life where I could have fun just creating characters, even if I was never going to use them. I would create characters left and right for games that I would never play, or create characters that maybe I would use in a game as a game master. You know, you need lots of background stuff. So, you know, I would create all sorts of characters, and tons of them just never, ever got used. But it didn't matter, because I just liked the process. And I get that. That's fun for a lot of people. It's been fun for me. It still is. But there's also something about being given a character, being given a set of stats and a set of abilities, and then deciding what it is that you're going to make of that. All right? And one of my favorite examples of this, I actually have two role-playing examples of my own that really cued me into how much fun I can have with pre-generated characters. The first was I sat in on a game of Dungeons & Dragons with some people I worked with back in college. And they had a long-standing campaign going, and I was just kind of, I just happened to be there for game night. And they're like, well, you know what, let's give you a character. Let's get you in here. And so the game master just handed me a character sheet. And the name at the top was Calamar. Apparently, he named me after his camera. And Calamar was a captain of the castle guard. So, you know, all these other people in the game are very important players that's, you know, related to the king and these important wizards and knights and very important people. And so I got to be Calamar, the captain of the palace guard. And and I had never been much of a player before. I was always a game master. But the character who handed me was Lawful Good. All right, for people familiar with D&D, that's the alignment that says that, you know, I'm a by the book kind of guy, interested in doing the best for everybody, and doing it, you know, by the rules as much as possible. Very goody-goody type. And I'd never really experienced that. I'm so used to being the GM. I'm so used to playing the bad guys and working in the devious motivations and the plotting and the mechanisms behind everything. And so to play this lawful good character, I just fell in love with it. He gave me something that was completely new to me, and I played Calamar, and I had a great time with him. And as it turns out, then there was this thing becomes uncovered that Calamar is actually, according to some hidden documents, the next in line for the throne, and there's people arguing about whether or not I had any right to do that, and could I step up and be king, and this kind of thing. And I just had I completely got into the character and totally got off on this idea of playing this very self-righteous guy who is, you know, he wants to do right by everybody, but then there's that self-aggrandizing part but he's also kind of enjoying this power, and he's kind of enjoying, and I just had a great time with a character that was completely not mine. I had no input into it whatsoever. But, you know, I walked it. I took the role, and I did my best with it. It's like any actor stepping onto a stage. You're given a role, a predefined role beforehand, in most stage productions, and then you do your best to get into that character and have fun being that character. And in a stage role, it even goes further in that, for the most part, they're giving you even the words to say and the actions to perform. Whereas in a role-playing game, they can give you the role, but then you decide how you want to play it. You decide what you want to say and what you want to do and be. And I just find that fascinating. And then the most recent one, I was at Gen Con with my son, obviously, I've talked about it a few times. And while we were there, we played a game of Pathfinder, like D&D. And they had pre-generated characters available. If you didn't have one already entered into the system, then you just take a random character that they just provide for you. And I went up there, and my son wanted to be the gunslinger, and somebody else was going to be a ninja, and somebody else. So they already filled in all these different roles. And so to kind of round out the group, I just took... I took a rogue, a thief, basically, the sneaky character type. And I just grabbed that, and it was an elf rogue. And then to go along with that, we're all members of the Pathfinder Society, and there's different factions within Pathfinder. And so I wound up taking, just randomly grabbed one of the Pathfinder organizations, and it turns out to be this group that was very, again, law and order by the book, very much like the old character, except now instead of being a palace guard, a would-be king who has to be this law and order type, I'm a rogue, I'm a thief, I'm a spy. And yet I've still got this same sense of duty and honor and, you know, obeyance to the law. And so to put that together, I mean, they just handed me these random elements. But to put that together, I created a character and a personality that I was really proud of, and I had a really good time playing it, even though, you know, it was a short game. We were there for 6 hours, one session of game, and, you know, it's a con game, a convention game, so we were focused heavily on actually solving the riddles and beating the monsters and moving forward with the plot, and not so much involved with, you know, character and back and forth and that kind of stuff, but we still had a good bit of that, too, and it was awesome, because I loved... you know, any section where they're telling, you know, everyone else in the group, especially the ninja, saying, oh, no, we need to do this. We'll break in here. And if we just knock them out, we can drag the bodies out. And I'm like, I kept going, whoa, hold on. We are guests in this town. How can you even think of circumventing, you know, we need to approach this more directly. We need to, you know, here I was the sneaky guy. Well, one of them, the ninja was obviously sneakier than me. But again, I had a great time with it. And then we'd have these discussions back and forth and finally come to a workable solution that everybody in the group could go with, but still wouldn't put us on the right track. And again, just had a blast. And so so to me, I guess, and of course, I'm speaking directly to the Fear of the Boot guys because I'm sure they all listen to my podcast. But the idea is, for those of you who have maybe rejected the idea of random encounter tables in the past, or who are repulsed by the idea of pre-generated characters where people hand you something, I would say rethink it, because it's just a different sort of challenge. And I'm not saying it's the best way to do things, but it's something that I have a lot of fun with on a really regular basis. And It's, again, you don't, yes, a random encounter table taken at face value, basically that, you know, if you follow the rules of early D&D, it says, well, if your group is wandering through the woods for X amount of time, then you should make a roll twice a day on the random encounter table and just see what happens to run into them. Yeah, that's kind of pointless. It's stuff that doesn't further your plot. It doesn't really help you very much. It's just time filler. It's teachers handing out worksheets because they just don't have anything better to do, or having you watch a film because, again, they don't have anything better to do. This is, instead, you can use random encounter tables. You can use random elements thrown into your game. And then, again, take that challenge, all right? Take that challenge to make those relevant to the plot. Roll them up. See what you get, and then figure out, okay, it says that ants are going to show up, and these walking living trees are going to approach my group. Okay, why? Why would they even be here? What would they want from my group, and how is that going to be relevant to what they're doing later? And you work it out. Again, something I have a lot of fun with, and I would just say to anybody who's down on them, you know, give it a chance. Don't knock it till you try it. You know, take a new approach to stuff. Hey, it's the science corner, and that means if you don't walk away now, you may be in danger of learning something. Today on Science Corner, I'm actually going to, first let me tell you how I got there. You ever go to look something up on the internet, especially Wikipedia? Wikipedia is evil for this. You go to look something up on Wikipedia, and as you're reading the article, you see something and you go, well, I didn't know that. And they provide you a convenient clickable link. And so you follow that link to another part of Wikipedia. And then another one. And then another one. And before you know it, you are completely off of your original topic. All right. But every single thing that you've read is just fascinating. It's just this whole Wikipedia surfing, this Wikipedia diving, that just, you just fall down the rabbit hole and it just keeps going. You never run out of really cool stuff to learn. All right. So, I've had experiences like this where I go into Wikipedia, for example, my brother and his lutefisk. And so I went on Wikipedia to actually look up how they go about making lutefisk. All right. And it was very interesting. But hey, while I'm in there, it links me to, its origins, and look, some primitive cultures of Scandinavia, and then it leads me to, look, the Lapp people of Scandinavia, and then I'm finding myself, you know, the Lapp people of Finland, in fact, reindeer herders that live up in the frozen north, and then I follow that through to a whole bunch about early Scandinavian cultures, and then I find myself reading the history of the area, which leads me to the Normans, Vikings and the Normans, and then the Norman invasions of France, and then the Norman invasion of England, the Normans in Italy, for goodness sake. I had no idea that the Normans got as far as sending some of their knights to Constantinople, and the trail just kept going. You know, so for here, from looking up this nasty, nasty jellied fish dish that my brother was eating on YouTube, I went to go look up how it was made, and I wound up reading history of Constantinople and Norman dukes in Italy, and it was just fascinating. All right, so recently I had another experience just like that, where the song, and I can't even remember why it came up, but the song Auld Lang Syne came up. And to me, I have absolutely no clue what that song means, because the lyrics appear to be in English, except that there's lots of parts that aren't. And so I went to go look up Auld Lang Syne. All I wanted to do was see the lyrics and find out what the heck they meant. I assumed it was some kind of, you know, some Middle English or some antiquated term that I just wasn't familiar with. And it turns out, no, Auld Lang Syne is not written in English. I was amazed. The original song was written, and I don't remember the guy's name, but it was written by a Scotsman, and it was written in the language Scots. Scots. Okay, I didn't know this, so I'm following Wikipedia links. And, okay, so what the heck is Scots? And I assumed, off the top of my head, that, they mean Scottish Gaelic, which is related to Irish Gaelic, which, by the way, as I follow the links, I found out that it's no longer called Irish Gaelic. It's just called Irish. It's the Irish language. But I look up Scots, the language, and I find out, no, Scots is not Scottish Gaelic, not even connected to the Celtic languages at all. The Celtic languages being the Gaelics, the Irish, the Scottish Gaelic, this kind of stuff. Those were the native languages of the British Isles before European invaders came in early on. No, it turns out Scots is actually an offshoot of English, that at some point the British Isles developed, you know, the Anglo-Saxons, and then, anyway, they developed the English language, or early English, and from that, the people who lived in the north in Scotland, that started to split off into its own separate language called Scots. Who knew? All right, and Scots is a nearly dead language now, because it turns out that Scots and English were close enough in composition that, you know, if you spoke Scots, someone speaking English is going to understand you perfectly well, and vice versa. There's going to be some accent difficulties and a few unfamiliar words and this kind of stuff, but for the most part, they're mutually intelligible. And so what happened to Scots as a language is they didn't realize it was its own language. When England took over Scotland, essentially, and made it the whole United Kingdom, they just assumed, it never occurred to them that it was its own language. They just assumed that these are rural country bumpkins who just don't know how to speak English properly. So it was just assumed that if you spoke Scots, what you were really doing was you were speaking bad English because you were stupid and uneducated. And so they embarked on a program of eliminating Scots, of correcting people on how to properly speak English. And so the Scots language just started to die out. And then at some point they finally realized that, wait a minute, you know, they gathered up all the old writings in Scots and realized, no, it wasn't just bad English. It was its own language, very, very similar to English, but its own language. I find that fascinating. Really? I had no idea that English had such a close cousin. And so as I'm reading through that, this then leads me to links for, you know, Scots is a dying language, and so it then leads me to, although it's seeing a really strong revival now, as people use it as part of their Scottish cultural identity. But it led me to other dying or dead languages of the British Isles. And so I wound up finding, and most of these that I found were actually Celtic languages, again, related to Irish and Gaelic. But apparently there was a Manx language, M-A-N-X, just like the cat, and the tailless cats, the Manxes. And the Manx language, primarily spoken on the Isle of Wight, was related to Irish, and the last native speaker of it died out 30-something years ago. But before he died, there were plenty of recordings of Manx language speakers actually talking. So we have lots of recordings of it. We have an entire Bible that was translated into Manx. So we have a really good idea of what the language is like in both written and spoken form. And so now people there, you know, it's become cool to revive that as part of their cultural identity. So now there are lots of people who speak Manx, who have learned Manx as a second language. There's just no native speakers of it anymore. Same kind of thing with Cornish, which from the area of Cornwall in England, had no idea that they got down to where there was just a handful of kids who were growing up speaking Cornish as their native language, and pretty much everyone else, or bilingually speaking Cornish and English. And again, would have died out except, we just hit this point where we have the resources and the time available to start teaching it again and learning it and making it part of a cultural identity. I just thought that was brilliant. And so so it then led me to think, as I'm following my links here through dying languages and related languages, I thought, what does this mean for Ebonics? Because, and for those of you who don't know Ebonics, the term was actually invented back in the 60s or 70s, I think, by linguists who were trying to put a description on the language spoken chiefly by African Americans in the United States. It is a version of English that has its own unique accents and words and phrasings and grammatical structure, and they were trying to distinguish it as a separate language. And then it came to a head, I don't know, 20 years ago, 10 years, 15 years ago, something like that, when some school in California wanted to actually make an official program including Ebonics to recognize that we have Black students here who are native Ebonics speakers, and therefore we need to approach them in a culturally sensitive way in order to teach them proper English, putting proper in quotes. and Ebonics, the term has fallen out of fashion in the scientific community, but it's still used, and usually it's used as a way to make fun of people. Ebonics is not taken seriously. The term is derisive and implying that, you know, people who are trying to be overly politically correct or overly culturally sensitive or something like that. But as it turns out, Ebonics is an actual, it's not its own language, but what it actually refers to is African-American vernacular English, which is an actual dialect of English spoken primarily by people who grow up in the black culture in the United States. And I thought to myself at first, African-American vernacular English, just saying it makes me feel a little bit racist. But as I look it up, again, following my Wikipedia links, it's closely related to Southern American English, which is that ignorant accent that's spoken by all the people that live down south, like my relatives. And I say ignorant in quotation marks. I'm just making a joke, people. So dialects of English. Let's follow that Wikipedia link. And it takes me to, did you know that there's 30-something dialects of English just in the United States? I mean, 30, 40, something like that. And my absolute favorite, all right, among things like, there's ones related to social cultural groups such as African American English, Latino English, this kind of stuff. There's also some that are just completely regional, there's Philadelphia English, there's Northeastern ones related to Boston, all this. But my absolute favorite one is Pennsylvania Dutchified English, which is exactly what it sounds like. I just love that Dutchified. It's completely made up, right? Right? I mean, Dutchified. And yet, there it is. In the science of linguistics, Pennsylvania Dutchified English is an actual term that is legitimately used by linguistical scientists to refer to that particular dialect of English spoken primarily in Pennsylvania, primarily by the Germanic and Dutch Amish people. And so this then leads me to looking at, did you know that they're not just all dialects? All right, it's a dialect. It's a version of English. It's usually really, connected to an accent and, specific words and phrases. But oh my God, they've actually narrowed it down to not just dialects, but ethnolects. Oh, a dialect related to a particular ethnic group. A regiolect, a topolect. These are ones that are related to particular areas of the country. And in fact, did you know that there's even a term idiolect? Idiolect, which sounds like a dialect for stupid people. But no, idiolect, I look it up, refers to just you. Just you and your individual speech patterns, how you talk as an individual person. That is your idiolect, your language, just for you. That was fascinating to me. So I start from Auld Lang Syne. I go all the way through Scots language, Scots culture, extinct languages, Ebonics, dialects, right down to just me. It's all about me, baby. Pretty cool.
Jamboree handouts, two turntables and a microphone. Bottles and cans, or just clap your hands, or just clap your hands.
Yeah, this is the Nerd Pride Turntable. Nerd Pride Turntable is just a wannabe music nerd talking about music. It's what I do. All right, the line here in the master list just says, karaoke. All right, you know what? I love karaoke. I had to bring this up, and there's a good reason for it. I've been to karaoke a few times, and the first couple of times I went, I was really shy about it. You never want to get up there. It's nerve-wracking to get up in front of a group of people and sing, because I can't sing. You guys have heard me sing, and you understand I can't sing. You know that. But what I found out is it doesn't matter, because I love hearing myself talk. I love being in front of people. I love being the center of attention. I wish I'd been in drama, in speech, and all of that when I was in high school. I would have been so good. Well, I don't even know if I'd be good at it, but I would have had fun doing it. Oh, I would have had fun. And so what I found out is that with karaoke, just put the feeling into it. That's all that matters. All right? So I go up and sing karaoke, and what happened to me, all right, first couple times I sang karaoke, me and my wife and my brother and his wife and my cousin and his wife, we were all in an amusement park in Florida, and we wound up, everywhere we went, We were all, as a group, singing Close to You by the Carpenters. All right, so we got on the roller coaster, and in the middle of the ride, we would be singing, Just Like Me, They Long to Be. And we were doing it in unison. We were just having a great time. This was our joke that we would sing Close to You everywhere we were. I don't know why. And as it turns out, we got to the haunted house there in the amusement park. And at the haunted house, while you wait for your turn to go inside, they had a dude running a karaoke machine outside. And we made a joke and started singing. And so he forces us to get up on stage. He calls us up there, and he has Close to You in his karaoke machine. And so he got us all to sing. And it was a lot of fun. And I sang way too loud, and I was way too awkward. But it was cute, and it was fun. A little nerve-wracking, but fun. next time I went out was with a bunch of coworkers, and I went up, you know, two or three times to sing stuff, but it was always with other people. All right. It's one of those, there's a lot of safety in numbers. And the first time you go to karaoke, you'll do that. You get some party song that everybody knows the words to, some old classic. And so everybody gets up there and sings. And my favorite was, we did Love Shack that night, and it was awesome. But then at the school Christmas parties, my wife's a teacher, and at the school Christmas party, they always have it at the same place that has a karaoke machine. The guy loves to break it out. So we have karaoke at the end of the night. And the guy, by the way, the guy that owns the place, and it's his karaoke machine, he is good. Oh, he loves to sing. He has a great time with it, and he's fun to listen to. But my wife put my name in to do karaoke, and she had me go up and sing Ice Ice Baby by Vanilla Ice, because I happen to know all the lyrics, and I enjoy singing it. It's just a fun song. And I was just nervous as hell. I wouldn't even get up there until she got up there to at least, you know, dance a little bit and sing back up for me. And, but it was great. I did it, and because Ice Ice Baby is, you know, if you don't have the lyrics memorized, you're never going to read them off the screen. All right, you can't read them fast enough and process them fast enough to get it going. But I happen to know them by heart. So I got there and I just performed the heck out of it. All right, I put all my heart into it and just did it. And I got the applause and the cheers, and I realized, oh, that's why you do karaoke. All right. And so I did a couple other songs that did not go over as well, but they were fun, and did some more group songs and this kind of stuff. And so now I am constantly, as I'm listening to new music, constantly looking for new songs that I can perform as karaoke. And the one that I really, really, really want to do is Sweet Home Alabama by the group Bama. And they performed it at the Jeff Foxworthy Roast, and I've seen them perform it a couple other places. And it's just a great, it takes the Sweet Home Alabama song and combines it with some rap portions that they do. And it's just a ton of fun, and I like the song. But unfortunately, they're a little-known group with a little-known song, and therefore the karaoke dudes never have it. Right? It's just not there to perform. But the other one I did, and this was awesome, I sang One More Minute by Weird Al Yankovic, and I've known this song since I was in high school. All right, I've known this song for 25 years, and it's one that is, it's goofy, it's a love song, a hate song in love song form, and it's funny, and the key to it is just singing it with all of the emotion in the world. I mean, I grabbed that microphone and I was rocking it, all right, as you can imagine. You've heard me recite and sing and speak on this podcast, and so you can imagine what a complete and total ass I made of myself, and it doesn't matter, because it was funny. All right, you just put the passion into it, and I just love doing that. I love being able to take that chance and just have fun. And so I've been looking at some other songs. I'm not going to tell you what they are, because it may surprise you. Because you know what I found out? I found out that my software that I use to edit this podcast has a function right there called voice removal, which means I can take any song, run it through voice removal, and all it does is take out the singing, while leaving the music relatively intact. It's not a perfect process, but certainly good enough for my purposes. So, you know what that means? Any day now, I may spring karaoke on you, and you guys are just going to have to sit there and take it. It'll be great. But enough of all that. You know what it's time for? It's time for music! All right. This is a band that my wife just found online, in the last month or so. And they are wonderful. They're called Mariachi El Bronx, and they are, quite literally, a modern mariachi band. And as you listen to the music, oh, yep, that's definitely mariachi. And you think it's a joke at first. But listen to the music, listen to the words. They're actually really good. I don't know if I could sit down and, you know, listen to hours worth of mariachi music, but I love mixing some of their songs in with my other playlists. And it's just, or imagine having a party, right? Having a big old party, and you actually have a live modern mariachi band, not singing old traditional tunes, but, you know, modern pumped up tunes with modern lyrics and issues and stuff like that. It's just fun, right? And so this is their song, Cellmates, and it's about a dude in prison asking his girl to wait for him. And it's just, it's a cool song.
In my defense, these prison walls, they couldn't hold anything in it all. I see your face in iron walls, and I keep crawling on back to you. Honestly, will you wait for me? Little world, promise me, one day I'm free. This kind of place, it brings you down.
See what I tell you. And Mariachi El Bronx has several other songs, and as you do some research on them, you find out that, you know, there's other mariachi bands like this out there making music, selling it on iTunes. Go find them. This one's my absolute favorite, and I'm just going to let it stay at that. But right now, it's time for the badass movie quote of the week. Okay. I saw this movie when it first came out. I was in high school. I went to see it with my mom, my dad, and both of my brothers, and it has been one of my absolute favorite movies since that moment. This movie is also the source of the single greatest movie quote of all time, and that's not the quote I'm going to give you today, but you'll know the one. All right, no, the quote I'm going to give you is towards the very end of the movie, all right, when Humperdinck has finally found Wesley in the bedchambers and has told him it's time to the death. And Wesley, of course, replies, "No, to the pain." And here's the quote. "To the pain means the first thing you lose will be your feet below the ankles, then your hands at the wrists, next your nose, and then my tongue, I suppose. I killed you too quickly last time, a mistake I don't mean to duplicate tonight. I wasn't finished. The next thing you will lose will be your left eye, followed by your right. And then my ears, I understand. Let's get on with it." "Wrong! Your ears you keep, and I'll tell you why. So that every shriek of every child at seeing your hideousness will be yours to cherish. Every babe that weeps at your approach, every woman who cries out, 'Dear God, what is that thing?' will echo in your perfect ears. That is what 'to the pain' means. It means I leave you in anguish, wallowing in freakish misery forever." Ooh. And of course, the single greatest movie quote of all time is, "My name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die." I have that on a shirt, and I love that quote. But that's not the one we're doing today. I love this. I love this bit. And it comes right at the end of the movie. And of course, the best part of that is that he's bluffing. "I knew he was bluffing. I knew he was bluffing." Yes. And so, just a great, great movie. I love it. Love the Princess Bride. And that was Cary Elwes as Wesley, the Dread Pirate Roberts, and Chris Sarandon as Prince Humperdinck. And just a beautiful, wonderful movie. That movie is a ton of fun. I don't care who you are. You love the Princess Bride, and I know you do. The other thing I'm going to do right now is, and we're just going to try this out and see how we like it. Hold on. Let me run the bumper for it. Sweet. This is going to be our word of the week. All right. The word of the week is going to be a new word that I introduced to you. Maybe you know it, maybe you don't, but it's not something that we commonly use. And your job is just to make use of it this week. Find a place to fit it in so it's not awkward. And most specifically, if you're a member of our forums, Use it in a sentence on the forums. Use it in context on the forums, and impress us all with the fact that A, you listen, and B, you're smart enough to apply the knowledge that you gain. All right, and our word this week is haver, H-A-V-E-R, haver. Why? Well, in the song 500 Miles by the Proclaimers, they have that line in there where they say, if I get drunk, you know I'm going to be the man who gets drunk next to you. And then followed that with, and if I haver, well, you know I'm going to be the man who's havering to you. And I always wondered what havering was. And since it followed getting drunk, I just always made an assumption that havering involved vomiting, because that's really what it sounds like to me. But then I couldn't understand why he'd be vomiting to the love of his life. But, you know, hey, what do I know about Scottish people, right? Except for, you know, the Scots language. And so, as it turns out, haver is actually a Scots word. That's where it comes from. And that's why it's used by the Proclaimers, being Scottish themselves. And haver actually means to babble. It means to run on at the mouth, to talk incessantly. Havering, much like I do here every single week. All right? So, that's your challenge. Take haver. Make it your own. Use it somewhere. You won't regret it. Podomatic. Hot dog. This is the Nerd Pride Radio Podomatic. At the end of every cast, I bring out R2 and his fully pimped out Pop-O-Matic bubble, and he rolls up random topics for me to talk about. And where do these topics come from? Well, that's where you come in. You want to hear me babble on about something? You want to hear me haver about something? Send your question or topic to me by email, or better yet, in a private message on our forums, and I'll add it to the Podomatic list. Podomatic is about whatever you want it to be. All right. And the first number that R2 has given us is a 19. Excellent, R2. And on my list, oh, good. Oh, good. I love this one. All right. This is from Snow in July, and it says, have you ever heard of the Laws Oot song of... The Laws Oot Song of Storms Paradox. That's what it is. If so, what's your opinion? Okay. I know Song of Storms, and I understand the reference, but for the life of me, when I got this question and I entered it into the list with all the others, I had no idea what Laws Oot means. And so I went to look it up, and like an idiot, I realized, okay, Laws Oot is Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time. Oh. Duh, because that's where the Song of Storms is from. I should have known that. All right. But here's the Song of Storms paradox, is that, and I don't remember all the details because it's been a while, but Link learns the Song of Storms, which is crucial to the plot here. He learns the Song of Storms from some guru, some old man, and I can't remember where you find the old man, but that's where he gets the Song of Storms from. But then, later in the game, Link goes back in time to replay through a time when he was 7 years old. All right, and so now he's 7 years in the past. He's a child, but apparently retains his future knowledge in some respects. And so when you ask the guru where he learned the Song of Storms, he will tell you that he learned it from that 7-year-old child in green. So, as it turns out, the guru learned the song from Link when he was a child, and then Link learned it from the guru, and it just creates a big circle. This is the paradox of the Song of Storms. And so the debate, one would assume, is, well, where did the song come from? Well, how did it get created out of thin air? And so one would then have to go on and presume all sorts of stuff, and there's lots of logic entered into it where people say that since it's impossible for this song to have come out of absolutely nowhere, why, clearly at some point in this circle, someone else had to interject. Someone else taught it to 7-year-old Link so that he could teach it to the guru, so that the guru could teach it to Link, who then, what, somehow forgets when he goes back in time? Or how did 7-year-old Link know the song, but then adult Link doesn't? And then, anyway. And the real answer, my opinion, is no, the song came out of nowhere. The song came out of absolutely nowhere, and that's all you need to know. There's nothing else to it. It was invented. The song itself was created by the energy of the time travel paradox. That's all it is. And how do I know? Well, because, hey, it all goes back to Dungeons and Dragons, doesn't it? When I was in high school, my brother and our friend Steve were playing a game of Dungeons and Dragons. And in this game, my brother was playing a warrior, and Steve was playing his halfling rogue companion. And my brother wound up being captured by some villain, who later we find out is a Time Lord. But he's captured by a villain, and he's put into an arena, and he's made to fight some dude. Okay, and we can't tell who the guy is. The guy looks tired and beat up. His clothes are torn, and the dude is missing a hand. All right, but he has this huge magic sword, and he comes in there and just starts whipping my brother's butt. But eventually, my brother starts coming back. All right, and the mystery warrior cuts off my brother's hand. This should have been the first clue. All right, winds up cutting off my brother's hand during combat, but then my brother comes back and slays the dude, and good, he's killed him. Good. Now, the Time Lord who had taken him prisoner and put him in this situation in the first place then takes him and Steve and takes them back in time on the other side of the arena. And now, this is where my brother realizes that that he is the mystery warrior. Oh, crap. Because the mystery warrior cut off his hand. Then my brother takes his sword and then, goes back in time. And now he's being sent back into the arena to replay the exact same combat from the other side. And he's freaking out because, well, you know, as they go through the combat, he fights. He cuts off his younger self's hand, and he realizes the killing blow is coming any moment. He's going to die because, well, he's already been through it, and he won the last time, so he knows he's going to die now. But at this point, Steve breaks his Staff of Luck, his prized possession, the Staff of Luck, which he has had forever. But they can't think of anything else to do, and so Steve says he is going to shatter his staff, release all the luck energy, and just see what happens. And so as a game master, I rule that, dude, if you're going to throw away your staff for this, all right, good. Then you're no longer locked into the prescribed series of events. Maybe things can be different this time. And sure enough, my brother winds up coming back and kills his younger self. And now he gets to survive. So now we have a couple of double paradoxes. One is, well, okay, how can he even be here if he killed himself in the past? And then two, where did the sword come from? He enters the arena with a magic sword. His younger self kills him to take the sword, much like the Song of Storms, and then that's where he gets the thing from. But now, since the Staff of Luck has changed the course of time, he now gets to walk away with this sword that didn't exist 20 minutes ago. Where did the sword come from? You know what? We never debated the paradox. The whole point is, no, because it is a time paradox, and because the shattering of the Staff of Luck allowed any of this to occur in the first place, this random magic sword has just appeared out of the ether, created wholly by the paradox itself. And that's all you need to know. I don't see why you have to make it more complicated than that, because here's the other thing about Law's Oot, is it's a video game. It doesn't have to be real. It doesn't have to follow our laws. All right, Dungeons and Dragons is a game, and that's all that matters. And so who cares if it makes sense? Who cares if you can find, you know, pick apart all the details of it? Who cares? All that matters is it was cooler than crap. We talked about that. Well, not only did we talk about that forever, I'm still talking about that adventure now because it was so cool. That's all that matters. Oh, R2, thank you for breaking me out of that. I so appreciate that. All right, R2 has rolled us a 50. Right in the middle. And this one, all right, this one is from Brasky. And Brasky says, you're DMing the most epic D&D game of all time. Your party consists of Will Wheaton, playing a kobold rogue, Eddie Van Halen, playing a human paladin, Jesus, playing an elf ranger, of course he would, and Hitler, playing a gnome druid. Assume that everyone is an equivalent of class level 7. My question is, what do you serve for snacks and refreshments? Well, that's easy. Cheetos and Mountain Dew. You did say we're playing D&D, right? See? This is one of those trick questions where they give you all this extraneous information when really the answer was just right there in the very beginning where it says you're playing D&D. That's all the information we needed. Everything else is just gravy. Nice try, though. Ha! Huh. Sweet! R2 gives us a 93! And this one is from McDiddles. Hi, McDiddles. How are you? McDiddles says, what is your favorite character from the Lord of the Rings trilogy? If it's not Gimli, I'll hurt you. Ha! Nice callback. you're going to have to hurt me because it's not Gimli. My favorite character from all of the Lord of the Rings is Tom Bombadil. No, I'm kidding. It's not. My favorite character from all of the Lord of the Rings is Samwise. Samwise Gamgee is my absolute favorite. That used to be my online identity. When I first got on the internet and I'd sign up for stuff, I always signed up as Samwise. And then later I realized that Samwise is really, really popular. There's lots of people who sign up for stuff as Samwise or Samwise Gamgee. And so I finally changed my online handle to something that wasn't taken at every frickin' place I went to. But Samwise Gamgee, Sam, is just an amazing character. I love the depth of him. He is portrayed as a simple person. All right, he's not the brightest bulb, clearly, but he knows what's right. All right, Sam is wise, not smart, but wise, and he always knows what's right. And he is Frodo's guiding conscience through most of the story of Lord of the Rings. And in fact, one could even argue that as much as Gollum had his own split personality issues going, you know, Gollum was the evil personality, or the evil conscience, and Sam would be the good one. And I've just always been impressed by that strength of character. I would love to play a character like Sam in a game. A character who is, again, not terribly bright, but even without the brains, he knows what's right and wrong, and all he cares about is what's best for everybody. That's it. All right? And I love him. I would play him as in D&D again. It's always D&D. I would play him as neutral good, and I would play him obviously low intelligence, high wisdom. Who cares what class he is? He could be a commoner. He could be a fighter. He could be a rogue. He can be anything you want. It's that personality that makes this character, and I love Sam. So I am sorry. As I do love Gimli. Lord knows Gimli is awesome. But, you know, if you've read The Hobbit, we had tons of dwarves in The Hobbit. But Gimli's pretty damn cool. And me personally, whenever I've played D&D and I've had my own option of characters to pick from, invariably, I almost always turn to dwarves and gnomes as my two favorite characters, your character types. Just something about playing the short, stocky, ugly, there's something cool about that. So there you go, Samwise Gamgee. And the number is 41. All right, this one is from Zimney Pot. And Zimney Pot says, do you have any weird phobias? Well, no, I don't. They're not weird at all. They are maybe unreasonable, but not weird. I've actually talked about this on the forums in the past, but I'll repeat it here since Zimney has asked the question. And my main fear, it's a fear of high places combined with children. The idea that, high places, heights, make me nervous. They give me a queasy feeling in my stomach. All right? I get a little bit sick standing at the top of a tower or at the top of some scary amusement park ride or even a tall building just looking out the window. I get this queasy feeling, but it's not like I'm scared. I enjoy it. All right? I can enjoy that part and enjoy the kind of sick feeling I get because of it. It's a little scary, but it doesn't debilitate me or anything. But you put my kids in that situation, especially when you go up to the top of a tall tower or going upstairs and there's no rail, or the rail is something that you could easily just duck under or crawl over. This scares the life out of me. Oh my goodness, I can't even, I have visions of the kids just falling from that height, and I mean, it is debilitating. My wife, we were at the Texas State Capitol building in Austin, and my wife was holding one of our kids, who was an infant or near infant at the time, and just walked up next to the rail, and she was looking over the rail a little bit. And I just had these visions of, oh my God, if he threw himself from her arms, he could just tumble right over that rail and plummet three stories to his death. And it panicked me. And I said something to her and then finally realized I just have to leave. I just can't watch. Cause I mean, she's holding him and he's completely safe and secure in her arms. She was holding him tight. She didn't even get him close to the rail. I mean, she's holding him way back while she puts her head over and just looks over the side. But even having him, you know, 2.5-3 feet away from the rail, it just scared me to death. I just couldn't take it. And I've had similar situations like that in plenty of places. most recently was when we were at Mount Rushmore. Again, we were doing the tourist thing. We're at Mount Rushmore, and Mount Rushmore has this balcony level above the main arena. And the balcony has this stone wall. And as long as my wife was holding our youngest son, I was cool, because the stone wall, the rail, came up above her waist. So it was above her center of gravity. So when she's holding him, even if he were to jump, oh, he'd just hit the wall and he'd be right here. But for me or for my oldest son, if either of us were holding him, why, we've got him now held up higher than the rail. Our center of gravity is higher than the rail. And the whole idea that he could just tumble right over the edge was just too much. And then, even worse, as I'm sitting here panicking about this, and I can't even look. I have to go back and sit a couple of rows back so I'm away from the situation. But before I got to that, I'm holding my son, and he just asks me, I don't know if he saw I was nervous or what, but here, the four-year-old has to go and ask me, "So, Dad, if I fell over that, would I die?" Oh, God, can't take it. So, there, that's my main fear. I don't know if it's weird, but I do know that many parts of it are really unreasonable. I mean, I justify it to myself by saying that, well, yeah, but it is a reasonable fear of things that actually could happen. Number 88. Thank you, R2. This one's from it's from Anonymous. Now, I told you I'm cutting out most of the anonymous ones, but there's a few of them that I left in just because they were interesting enough. I moved some of them over to my master list so I can talk about them in a more planned fashion. But there's still a few of them here in this list, but they'll slowly get whittled out as people keep adding to it. And Anonymous says, "If you weren't running a game for your kids, what D&D class would you choose for yourself?" Well, I've already halfway answered my new D&D character question in one of the last ones. If I was going to play D&D right now and I was going to choose for myself, I would be playing a gnome bard. That's just, I have this vision in my head, and it is a gnomish bard, but a very serious one. Not one of these frivolous, you know, half almost elven looking gnomes. No. Very serious gnome who performs as a bard, and his chief performance is chanting and drums. So he's not even playing one of these sissy little instruments, you know, like a lute or anything like that. No. He's got serious drum work going on with this heavy beat and these serious dance steps that go along with his magic. And he would be versed in the traditions of storytelling and passing along, you know, epic poems and epic tales in the form of these poems. And I just think he's the coolest guy. That's who I want to play. I've been wanting to play this guy for a couple of years, probably even longer than that. And I've just never had a chance because I don't play. I'm game master. I'm always the dungeon master. In fact, I'm currently sitting in my dungeon mastering chair as I record this. And I'm very comfortable in this role. But yeah, if I had a chance to play, that's what I'd do. Gnomish Bard. That would be my dream character, at least right now. I would really want to explore that. And it's a 61. Again, this is from Anonymous, and Anonymous asks, "Who's hotter, librarians or teachers?" Did I not mention I'm married to a teacher? Hot, hot, hot. So, I get, there's not even any room for discussion on this one. Teachers hotter than librarians. All right. Whoa, R2, I don't even know if I should have had your roll yet because, man, I didn't even realize how late we were getting on time. But we'll go ahead and we'll do one last one. This is number 15. It's from Snow in July again. And Snow in July asks, "Was there ever a time when you didn't want to be a nerd?" Oh, you know what I love about this question? Is that I have presented myself in such a happy and confident way that I am making it appear that being a nerd is something absolutely desirable, something that I have always dreamed of and wanted, all right? Which nowadays, absolutely true. I am unbelievably proud of who I am and of my nerd status and of the things I do and the things I've accomplished as a nerd. I love my podcast. I love my website. I love my kids and my family. And I feel like I've done really wonderful things. And I am a nerd and completely, totally proud of it. But to say, you want to be a nerd? I've never had a choice. I mean, I clearly want to be now, but I've always been one, and there was never any option for me in the mix. I mean, if you had seen me at 4 years old in my big old horn-rimmed glasses, well, they weren't really horn-rimmed glasses. They were big old thick military issue frames, and they were, I was a nerd from day one, and there was just no getting around it. I was always precociously smart. I always looked the part, and my interests have always been nerd interests. It's just what I do, all right? But there have been many, many, many times in my life growing up when I didn't want to be a nerd. Many times when I worked really hard to push that part of myself away or hide it from others so that I could be something else. That I thought by being something else or someone else, I thought that all these good things would come to me. That suddenly, you know, if I didn't project this huge nerd image, why, I would have a chance at hanging out with popular people and dating girls and that somehow it would make me a better person or that I'd be happier or more successful. And as it turns out, none of those things ever happened for me. One, I was never able to completely hide the fact that I'm a nerd, just because I got rid of all of my D&D stuff and all of my gaming stuff and sold it all at a garage sale when I was in high school didn't stop me from being a nerd. It just meant that now I was a nerd who didn't have my games anymore, and that made me really sad, right? It certainly didn't get me in good with the girls. It didn't get me a date. I wish I had just been happier with myself. I wish I hadn't wasted so much time trying to figure out who I wanted to be, because I was already that person. I mean, is that silly? Does that sound schmaltzy? A little bit. But yeah, there's been plenty of times I didn't want to be a nerd. But now I'm so glad I didn't ever really have the option of changing it. I mean, yes, it feels like a lot of wasted time in my life, but I also learned a lot from it. And I'm very, very happy with where the journey has gotten me. So on that note, this podcast is copyright 2011 by Nerd Pride Radio. The opening and closing theme is from Sabotage by the Penelopes. Our music this week was Mariachi El Bronx with their song Cellmates. If you feel like doing something nice for the podcast, head on over to iTunes. Write a nice review. If you want to contact me, you can always email me at mike@nerdprideradio.com or check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/nerdprideradio. But to be totally honest, the best way to talk to me is to come sign up for our forums at nerdprideradio.com/forums. Sign up and send me a message. Hang out. We'll have fun. It's a good time. That music means that it's time for Mike Was Wrong. I know, usually I do this at the beginning of the cast, but as it turns out, I was wrong in the cast and it screwed everything up. So remember when I told you that I had software that could remove the vocals from music? Yeah, it turns out I don't. I'm using Audacity, a beautiful free software from the internet, and the first song I tried it with, it took the voice out, it left me with just the music, it worked beautifully. So I was planning on doing some karaoke right here for the end of the podcast, and I was going to sing 500 Miles by the Proclaimers to fit in with the theme of the show. And what happens? It doesn't take the voices out. It took one guy's voice out, but not the other. So I was stuck. So I thought, okay, I'll do Ice Ice Baby. Doesn't even phase it. One More Minute by Weird Al? No, nothing. So, as it turns out, Audacity has completely failed me in this one regard, and therefore, you guys don't get a song. I'm terribly, terribly sorry.